tamp down any motion to vacate Thread by publicly supporting Mike Johnson, even if he didn't directly say he opposes Marjorie Taylor Greene's attempt to oust him as Speaker. While he dodged the main question everyone wanted answers to, whether or not he opposes Greene trying to oust Johnson, Trump did express frustration that the motion to vacate has been used this Congress. Donald Trump said, "It's unfortunate that people keep bringing it up." CBS News has also covered the same story. A photo op was worth a thousand words for House Speaker Mike Johnson on Friday, 12th of April, as he stood alongside former President Donald Trump at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida, presenting a united front at a critical time in Johnson's tenure to announce a new GOP election integrity bill. Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee for president, told reporters that Johnson is doing a really good job under very tough circumstances, precisely the endorsement that Mike Johnson needed as he tries to fend off a threat to his speakership from Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. Donald Trump said he gets along very well with Greene, but made it clear that House Republicans shouldn't undertake another drawn-out battle for the speaker's gavel anytime soon. "We're getting along very well with the speaker, and I get along very well with Marjorie," Trump said. "We have a speaker. He was voted in, and it was a very complicated process. I think it's not an easy situation for any speaker. I think he's doing a very good job. He's doing as good a job as you can do, and I'm sure that Marjorie understands that." The press conference was ostensibly about the new election integrity bill that Mike Johnson said House Republicans will take up soon. The speaker said the still unreleased legislation would require proof of citizenship to register to vote and closes loopholes in state voter registration protocols that require voters to assert their citizenship, but not necessarily to prove it. States would also be required to remove any non-citizens from voter rolls, Mike Johnson emphasized.
Gaza, October 7th. Boats are moving up and down in the cool sea breeze. Seagulls flying over the beach. The law before the storm. Suddenly, a bulldozer breaks the Israeli-built fence around Gaza. No one really knows what is happening. In no time, fighters from Gaza take control of the Beit Hanun crossing. A land, air, and sea attack into the heart of Israeli-occupied territories. Palestinian forces attack military installations and take over various settlements. The Israelis in the Sharon Plain wake up to the blare of sirens. They're caught off guard. Danger is around the corner. They don't expect their holiday to be ruined like that. Israel describes the operation as an unprovoked attack, blaming Hamas for disturbing the peace in the region. In the United States, politicians echo the same narrative. Former U.S. President George W. Bush calls Hamas cold-blooded killers.
This is an unprovoked attack by terrorist people willing to kill innocent people to achieve an objective. And don't be surprised if Israel takes whatever action is necessary to defend herself. And it's going to be ugly for a while. You're dealing with cold-blooded killers.
But is the Palestinian group's operation really an unprovoked attack? And isn't there anything surprising about it?
Let me show you a map of the Middle East.
Just a couple of weeks before Hamas launched Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had unveiled his future map of the region at the United Nations General Assembly. The map had no place for Palestinians, and Israel still included the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as well as the occupied and illegally annexed Golan Heights of Syria. The little map was in fact the blueprint for the complete elimination of Palestine from the region for the sake of the so-called Greater Israel. Israel's prolonged policy of ignoring Palestinians' rights as a nation is clearly reflected in its illegal settlement projects. Built on usurped territories, these settlements and their cancerous expansion have dashed Palestinians' hopes for establishing their own state and ending their lingering limbo as a nation under occupation. In recent years, the Israeli regime has put settlement expansion at the top of its priorities. In one of the recent cases, Netanyahu passed a controversial resolution in June 2023 and gave a carte blanche to his cabinet to construct more settlements in the occupied West Bank. One month later, the head of the Regional Council for West Bank Settlements, Yossi Dagan, submitted a proposal to Netanyahu to increase the number of Jewish settlers in the northern West Bank from 170,000 to 1 million by 2050. There are already over 700,000 Israeli settlers living in 176 settlements and 186 so-called outposts in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds. All of these settlements and outposts, and the settlers who live in them, are illegal under international law. Since occupying the West Bank and Gaza, Israel has unilaterally declared tens of thousands of hectares of a so-called state land for Israeli settlements. Mushrooming across Palestine, these illegal settlements have made life excruciatingly difficult for Palestinian communities, aggravating their already dire situation. In addition to depriving the families of a home, which is the main asset and source of mental, physical, and economic security, the settlement building and its concomitant evictions of Palestinians frequently result in the loss of livelihoods and expansion of poverty. These settlements always come with the uprooting of Palestinian trees, destruction of their cultivated land, and discriminatory management of water resources in favor of the settlers. To make life even more difficult, restrictions have been imposed on Palestinian movement and access to resources. The Israeli regime has set up checkpoints, barriers, and separation walls that drastically limit the freedom of movement for Palestinians. This has had a profound impact on their daily lives. It affects movement within parts of the occupied Palestinian territories between the West Bank and Gaza, as well as between occupied Palestinian territories and the rest of the world. Since 2007, Gaza has been subjected to a crippling blockade, which has caused immense suffering and a humanitarian crisis. The food supply is also limited by the siege. From 2007 to 2010, Israeli authorities kept a calorie count of Palestinians' nutritional needs to narrowly avoid malnutrition while restricting access to food for the people in Gaza. Today, according to the World Food Program, a significant portion of the population is food insecure. In 2022, 1.84 million people across Palestine, one-third of the population, did not have enough food to eat. Among these people, 1.1 million were considered severely food insecure, 90% of whom lived in Gaza. The Strip also suffers from an energy crisis. The Israeli ban on the entry of fuel into Gaza means that electricity production is severely limited. In 2023, before the Hamas-Israel escalation, Gaza had only 13 hours of electricity a day. The blockade has also taken a toll on the Strip's medical facilities. Hospitals lack basic supplies, equipment, and infrastructure, and are unable to handle severe cases or provide proper care for the chronically ill. The blockade also has crippled the economy, leading to high unemployment rates and widespread poverty. With nearly half of the population out of job, the Gaza Strip has one of the highest unemployment rates in the world. Data also indicate that more than 80% of the Gazans live in poverty. The blockade has turned the territory into an open-air prison where the residents have no place to go, no job to do, and no hope to cling to. According to the UNRWA report published in August 2023, for at least the last decade and a half, the socioeconomic situation in Gaza has been in steady decline. Israel's inhumane behavior usually takes even a harsher form. The regime's military operations in Gaza have led to high civilian casualties and widespread infrastructure damage. The destruction of homes, schools, and hospitals has left countless Palestinians dead, displaced, or in desperate need of assistance. Allah! just within the period of a few weeks since October 7th, over 10,000 Palestinians have lost their lives, including over 4,100 children. In fact, in every action the Israeli regime takes, there is one recurring feature: lack of respect for Palestinian lives. From 2008 till September 2023, 6,407 Palestinians were recorded to have been killed by the Israeli regime, more than half through missile attacks. Targeting Al Ahli Hospital in Gaza on October 17th that killed more than 500 Palestinians was the very epitome of the regime's brutality. At the same time, Tel Aviv is also accused of using white phosphorus in its military onslaught on Gaza. The banned substance puts civilians at risk of serious and long-term injuries. As a weapon, white phosphorus has a significant incendiary effect that can severely burn people and set structures, fields, and other civilian objects in the vicinity on fire. Israel's use of the deadly chemical violates international norms. Prior to October 7th, there were about 5,200 Palestinians in Israeli prisons, kept under dangerous prison conditions. Of this number, nearly 2,000 were condemned to life sentences on trumped-up charges. Palestinian prisoners are subjected to torture, starvation, and thirst while being prevented from accessing their medicine. Israel is using different legal pretexts to withhold the detainees from different areas. Palestinians from the Gaza Strip who were arrested inside Israel are being held under the Unlawful Combatants Law, which allows authorities to detain Palestinians indefinitely without effective judicial review. The law defines an unlawful combatant as a person who has participated either directly or indirectly in hostile acts against Israel, or is a member of a force perpetrating hostile acts against Israel. On October 13th, Israel amended the law to make it easier to arrest Palestinians on mere suspicion. The unlawful combatant law is the equivalent of the so-called administrative detention in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds, which allows Israel to hold Palestinians from those areas indefinitely under secret evidence, practically meaning under no evidence. The number of prisoners has now risen to more than 10,000 people. Since October 7th, Israel has arrested some 4,000 laborers from Gaza and more than 1,000 people in the occupied West Bank. Just a few days before Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, thousands of settlers carried out provocative tours of the mosque complex, following calls by extremist Jewish groups. Since the occupation of the East Al-Quds in 1967, Tel Aviv has allowed Israeli extremists to intimidate and violate the sanctity of the mosque. Under the so-called status quo agreement, only Muslims are allowed to pray inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Entering the mosque with boots on, beating worshippers, firing bullets and grenades, as well as vandalizing the site, have become common scenes in Al-Aqsa, the third holiest place for Muslims. In just 1 year, between September 2021 and September 2022, nearly 50,000 right-wing Jews raided Al-Aqsa Mosque. Is only part of the systematic Israeli campaign to Judaize Al-Quds. Against such a backdrop, the betrayal of the Palestinian cause by some Arab states in the form of the so-called Abraham Accords in 2022 and rumors that Saudi Arabia was just following suit could be regarded as the last straw. The normalization of ties between major Arab states and the Israeli regime sends shockwaves through the occupied territories. Forgotten by the international community, betrayed by Arab brothers and oppressed by the brutal regime of Israel. Palestinians are left with two hard choices: to give up the homeland altogether or to die for it. There is nothing surprising that Operation Al-Aqsa Flood was launched from Gaza. It is an impoverished, congested place inhabited largely by Palestinian refugees expelled from their homes during the Nakba of 1948. Gaza has also been under a debilitating siege for years, which has taken a heavy toll on its people. In fact, what appears to be the largest military response by Palestinians in decades is an inevitable development, an act of resistance and a reaction to the suffering of the nation under a brutal blockade and occupation. It is part of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. This struggle for freedom is, however, an uphill battle. The Israeli regime, in blind rage, has undertaken a new episode of mass killing of civilians. Israel is carpet bombing Gaza. Telecommunications infrastructure has been bombarded, effectively cutting off Palestinians in Gaza from the rest of the world. Tel Aviv has imposed a full blockade on Gaza, with no water, electricity, food, or medicine entering the strip. Meanwhile, the West Bank has been completely blocked. Checkpoints closed all across, paralyzing the whole territory. Israeli soldiers are shooting Palestinians and encouraging settlers to do so as well. Genocide is in the making. Israeli jets will continue to pound Gaza as long as the Gazans' hearts continue to pound for their land. But how many more Palestinians have to get killed? How many more men? How many more women? And how many more children? Life has lost its meaning for the Palestinians, who have been stripped of their homeland. So the only thing they care about is taking back their stolen land, their own land. That's the red line drawn by their blood.
diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Shaima al-Sawaf is one of hundreds of families across Gaza partly or entirely wiped out by the Zionist regime bombardment. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, the life of Shaima al-Sawaf was turned upside down in an instant. The 30-year-old, who has lived in Jordan since her marriage in 2013, lost 50 members of her family after an Israeli regime missile weighing hundreds of kilograms struck their home in Gaza. The al-Sawaf family is one of hundreds of families in the Gaza Strip that have been partially or wholly wiped out by the Zionist regime's bombardment of the enclave since October 7th. Last summer, Shaima visited her family in Gaza. She spent weeks with them as if she was saying goodbye without knowing it. Among those killed were her father, Mustafa, her mother, Maha, her brothers, Mahmoud, Montasser, Marwan, and Ahmad, her nieces and nephews, Bara, Maha, Karam, Shahad, and Omar, her sister-in-law, Zain. Omar was the youngest at only 18 months old, while a number of her uncles, cousins, and their wives also lost their lives. The bad news arrived quickly. Hours after the bombing, Shaima was able to call her cousin, who continued to cry bitterly down the phone. Shaima's husband took the phone and spoke to him, then fell silent, ended the call, and tears began to flow down his cheeks. I went crazy. I lost my nerve. I started screaming. Tell me who among them died, recalled Shaima. She said, he said desperately, all of them. I had a nervous breakdown and didn't feel anything around me after that. More than 31,000 Palestinians have been martyred in the ongoing Zionist regime's assault, while more than 71,000 have been injured, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. 40 days before the start of the Zionist regime's assault, Shaima left for her home in Amman. When she met her husband, a refugee from Jaffa, and left Gaza, she felt that she had left a piece of her heart behind. But she remained in daily contact with her family for hours, following their news and sharing their events from a distance. She said, the war began with a constant anxiety inside me. I could barely sleep and I watched the news and the sights of the Israeli bombing, which didn't differentiate between man, woman, child, elderly, sick and wounded. If I hadn't left, if I had stayed and died with them. With the beginning of the Israeli regime airstrikes, Shaima's long calls to her family turned into short words just to make sure they were okay. The family left their home in the Sheikh Ajlin neighborhood when the bombing intensified and moved to a residential building in At-Tofa area where Shaima's uncles live and where her father also had an apartment. At dawn on November 18th, Shaima read the news that a residential building had been targeted in the same area. She was terrified and started crying while trying to contact her family, but no one answered. She said, "My anxiety and fear increased. My husband tried to calm me down, but I felt a disaster was approaching. Communications were cut off from Gaza and I knew nothing. I didn't sleep. I didn't eat. I did nothing but pray and cry." Due to the lack of facilities and the imposed siege, the civil defense crews were unable to work effectively at the site of the bombing. The whole family was struck under the rubble and were extracted dead, except for Zaid, aged 8, the son of Mahmoud, who was killed with his wife and the rest of their children. Shaima describes what happened as an unforgettable tragedy. Little by little, the news began to reach Shaima. The next day, she received word of the survival of her brothers, Muntasir, Marwan, Mu'taz, and Muhammad, who were injured. Muntasir, her journalist brother, who lost one of his eyes in the bombing, called and began to console her and reassure her about him and the rest of her siblings who had survived. She said, "I continue to cling to the hope that a number of my siblings had survived, despite my intense pain over the loss of my parents and my nephews. I spoke every day with Marwan and Muntasir, and I didn't know that these were farewell calls to them as well." On December 1st, an Israeli regime plane bombed the Al-Daraj neighborhood in Gaza City, killing Muntasir, Marwan, and a number of other relatives. Muntasir remained bleeding for about half an hour without any ambulances being able to reach him. Rayyan 10, one of Shaima's three children, sits in his room in Amman and cries hard. Shaima said he loved his cousins very much and talked to them constantly. He had a special relationship with my father. I'm still in pain like the first day of the massacre. I talk to their pictures and imagine them next to me. The most painful thing for Shaima is that she couldn't look at them one last time before burying them because of the war and siege. She said, "Gaza is everything I love, and it has the smell of my family and their memories," adding she hoped to return one day. Shaima is left with only her two brothers, Mu'taz, and the injured Muhammad, who needs to travel for treatment but still can't. She talks to them daily and they try to heal their wounds together by remembering the family members amid constant fear due to the continued Israeli regime aggression. Before the war began, due to a glitch in her phone, Shaima lost her photos of her family and was unable to recover them. She said, "I got very angry and cried more. I want to look at them again, but I don't have all the pictures. Our first house was completely bombed and turned into rubble, and all my brothers' phones were crushed by that." Today, Shaima lives a severely diminished life. Despite everything that has happened, she says that she's still waiting for one of them to contact her, even if the wait is forever.
Citizens under surveillance.
To watch without being seen, that's the spirit of surveillance. It's always present in the citizens' lives, but in the past 10 years, along with the pace of technological advances, we have witnessed a revolution. Targeted surveillance has gradually turned into mass surveillance worldwide. In the past, it only focused on public areas, but now it's violating our privacy. Closing the door or drawing the curtains at home is not enough anymore. The invisible eye is settled in our privacy. Online items and games, activities on social networks, local details of our smartphones, and inquiries on the search engines. Our online life turns into data. The information that, when processed, makes a new form of identity on which we have no control. Our private life could be laid bare in a matter of moments. This is what we will watch in this preventive film. A few minutes would be enough for four hackers to tap into all this information. This experience is a warning. Our online life doesn't belong to us. Never have we been scrutinized so much. 70% of our calls by mobile phones are recorded. Millions of hours of discussion by webcam are diverted by the secret services. Our existence is now accessible on the internet in the form of databases, and every single detail of our lives is retained in the memories by the storage centers. Who records this valuable information? How is it exploited, and for what purposes? We have conducted a survey for 2 years in Europe and in the United States. We went to meet the experts in digital surveillance, hackers and whistleblowers, and also the web giants such as Google or Facebook, and also the secret services that process and collect our data. As the boundaries between surveillance, technology and power fade, we will see that the gap is growing between two groups. On one side, defenders of individual freedoms, and on the other, supporters of cyber surveillance. A paradigm shift that can lead the citizens towards a new social model.
I think, you know, our modern societies are facing a choice about the future, and I think it's fundamentally a political choice. I think we could decide through an action to say, well, you know, we don't care very much about this. We don't care very much if the government gathers up all this information. We don't care very much about who has access to it, how it's used. We don't care if our children grow up in such a world of constant surveillance. And I think that could happen.
And it was to protect our privacy that on September 5, 2001, only a few days before the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the European Union was going to adopt the historical sanctions against the United States in order to make it cease the large-scale spying on phone calls and fax messages, and especially to make it give up the establishment of email surveillance. Europe knew that since the Second World War, the NSA, along with the intelligence services of its Anglo-Saxon allies, monitored the old continent under a program called Echelon.
That information, which is far, far larger than it ever has been in the past, because we now have the mechanisms to collect it, store it, and process it, and there's an economic incentive to do so as well, because it's very valuable information, this huge data avatar that follows us around, sort of like a spirit of Greek mythology, we're aware still of our physicality. We're still primed in that universe in our thinking.
Maria Costea is the first citizen to bring an action before the European Court of Justice. Google played its best trumps against him. Francesco Diaz, former European Commissioner Mario Monti's right-hand man, became the lawyer of the large monopoly groups. He manages a group of about 10 lawyers. The Grand Inquisitor, a Spanish, defends Google in Brussels. The result? The pressure was inflicted anyhow. The prosecutor himself considers that Google, as much as the search engine is concerned, is not responsible for the data processing. Accordingly, Mario's complaint is inadmissible. But the last word in this affair, after being deliberated upon, would be rendered by the judge of the European Court.
As controller,
we recognize that there are concerns in Europe and other places about companies that are successful, that have that have wide scope and have done well and that are large. And so we recognize that, and we always are willing to listen. We've cooperated over the last several years with the European Commission in its investigation relating to our search products, and we believe we have a resolution of that that we hope will be finalized soon. And we will continue to work with regulators and legislators across Europe to make sure that we strike the right balance on all of these things.
The European law that regulates the protection of data goes back to 1995. Back then, the internet was only in its infancy. By his action, Mario has changed this legal gap and opened a basic deliberation about it. A year later, surprisingly, the verdict of the European Court changes in favor of Mario and the Spanish Agency for Data Protection. It was unprecedented. The judge declared that Google was well aware of the data processing. Maria Castella could finally request to restore the circumstances that incriminated him. The Silicon Valley giant had to comply. The operator of an internet search engine is responsible for the processing of the personal data that appear on the web pages published by third parties. The right to be forgotten becomes an applicable right for every European citizen. Spain's everyday internet warrior who cut free from Google's tentacles. The right to be forgotten, Google dismissed by the European Court.
We've been working on this case for several years. I think when we heard the ruling from the European Court of Justice, we were somewhat surprised. And again, we thought the ruling was flawed and continue to think that and think there should be a dialogue in Europe about how to implement the right to be forgotten and perhaps through legislation or other dialogue figure out a way to implement it perhaps in a more focused way. But we felt that it was a problem that and we would have problems implementing it because it's very hard to figure out what are the circumstances under which you remove a search result without feeling like you're censoring information, right? And I think that in the past few weeks we've seen a number of examples where they've been very, very difficult decisions, and these are decisions that, there's also a question about whether a private company is the right place to make those decisions. But the court says that indeed that we should be doing it.
Google has already received 145,000 internet applications from Europe. However, this decision of the European Court is a partial victory for European internet users. First, because Google becomes a judge and a party, and then because Mario's data will still be visible from outside the European Union.
Who is in control? Who should have the power in an information society? I mean, that is one of those big questions. And the powers are, of course, increasingly strong if you see what the value is of all this information being developed. So this is why in the review of the European rules, we have now seen the concept of mega fines running into millions and possibly billions of euros. To make sure that the incentives are strong enough. And I think that if we introduce those much stronger mechanisms, we can control, reduce, steer gradually those new forces.
In reaction to the rapid development of the data storage and recordings, the first experiences of the citizens' resistance are beginning to emerge. The challenge is a complex one. How should we find some other alternatives that can allow each of us to be in control of our own data? How should we maintain a day-to-day online life beyond the reach of the tentacles of internet giants? This is a challenge set by Alex Pentland, the director of the MIT Media Lab and the great defender of internet privacy.
So the question is, how can we achieve this control over our digital identity? It turns out that it appears that there's at least a very good solution, maybe not a perfect solution, that's relatively easy to achieve. It requires that people be given notification when there's data recorded about them. It requires that people knowledgeably understand what's happening with that data and have the right to say what happens with data about them. So that just as you have the right to say what happens with your own body, you have the right to say with data about you. That's called provenance and permissions.
How to secure the data? By what means should we give every citizen control over their data? This is the subject of an experiment carried out in Trento in northern Italy with the participation of MIT and Alex Pentland. Thanks to funding from the city of Trento and the telecommunications companies, this small town has become the laboratory of dozens of researchers. Whereas our data leaves us from everywhere, the users have set up a cloud on the scale of the city in which each participant has a personal mailbox and can choose the data they want to share with the Trento community. They are 150 volunteer guinea pigs equipped with Phonix phones to instruct the users to scrutinize their personal activities. The objective is to determine the benefit that we can all enjoy by controlling our data. Amy, an American mother who has been dwelling in Trento in recent years, agreed to participate in the experiment for a year.
Something similar to what I'm doing, or you did it earlier today?
I'm going around with GPS turned on. How is that data then available, and what can be extracted from that? It's interesting to know, first of all, what that data is. So for me right now, I'm participating because I'm interested to see the kinds of data that they're collecting and to see the possibilities, the things that they can do with it.
Thanks to the secure cloud created by the Living Lab, Amy can choose the personal data that she wants to share. The researchers help her determine what data she is interested in making public in order to draw a social benefit. We follow Amy, who is going to visualize her data and the people she shares it with.
So this is essentially the homepage that they give us that allows us to have access to the data that we have in the system. One of the basic pieces of information is the profile. So if I go here, I can see the information that they have about me, and then I can decide how much of this data that I want to make available to the other people who are in the project. I can see the same information that I see on my phone. And I can see, for example, I have a friend who's participating in this, and this is the information that she has made available. Privacy today is certainly different than privacy was 20 years ago before we had devices and internet connections and all of these things. So it's true that closing your door gives you some amount of privacy, but we're always online. So there have to be things that change about how we maintain privacy today versus 20 years ago or whenever. But at the same time, you should still be able to maintain that level of privacy to say, I close my door, I don't share these things.
You want to be able to turn it off if you don't like it. When you give people that power, then they become more willing to share. And that, to me, moves towards a creative sharing society, which is the direction we want to go. Is it perfect? No. Is it a lot better than we are today? Yes. Do we have to do it now? Absolutely, because we're at a tipping point where these little companies in the gray and the NSA are beginning to steal our digital freedom, our digital self, is evaporating into serfdom or slavery. We need to restore, or create, perhaps more accurately, our digital persona and our rights to autonomy and self-control of our digital autonomy or persona.
far from Trento and the project of personal data security advocated by Alex Pentland. We're all devoid of privacy because of those who have a stronghold on the internet. And on these servers, we abandon a very great part of our personal history to these operators that are not willing to share their control. We leave a big part of our lives there, and they come there to search who we are, what we are, who we love, and who we hate. The multinational internet companies and the intelligence services of the most technologically advanced countries seem to share the common goal of reducing our private lives to nothing. Our data, stored without any real control, represent a potentially massive surveillance that is never equal. A new form of power that is concentrated on the outer Atlantic.
What I wanted to see is if you could give me a yes or no answer to the question, does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans?
No, sir.
It does not.
Not wittingly. There are cases where they could inadvertently, perhaps, collect, but not wittingly.
3 months after Edward Snowden, a simple systems administrator at the NSA, made the statements of James Clapper a state lie, he published the top secret documents of the agency that revealed the existence of a massive surveillance program, not only on American citizens, but also on the whole world. Unlike other whistleblowers like Thomas Drake, who just testified against the NSA, Edward Snowden left with thousands of top-secret documents from the agency. The request contained a highly confidential order from the Secret Court of Justice, FISA, forcing Verizon, one of the most principal U.S. telephone companies, to hand over some comprehensive information about the calls of its American customers to the NSA. Snowden is one of the international presses there. Lawyer Jesslyn Raddick, the former member of the U.S. Department of Justice, who had defended Thomas Drake and other whistleblowers, was in charge of defending Edward Snowden. His case became a state affair.
I take that seriously when a former CIA director says that my client should be hung by his neck from a tree, should be lynched. When the former director of NSA jokes with the chair of the House Intelligence Committee about putting my client on the assassination list. I'm not going to take any chances, and that means I have to do a lot in terms of encrypting and protecting myself and my clients, and not just Snowden, but all of my intel clients.
Snowden transmits thousands of documents that he gains to several influential newspapers so that they can continue the investigations. A team from the Washington Post received the prestigious Pulitzer Prize for its contributions. Among them was Ashkan Soltani, an independent journalist and a renowned specialist in internet security and internet privacy.
And even in the warranted targeted surveillance where they get a FISA order, where they go to a court and they get approval or they provide the justification under FAA, the FISA Amendments Act, that the bulk of the information or the people that they surveil were not actually the ones they intended to surveil, right? So if I'm a target, everyone that I communicate with, whether it's via email or if I'm on a chat line, if I'm on a chat forum, all of those people's communications are also collected and stored by the NSA. And why that's interesting is two things. One, that you cast this wide net, right? So imagine you're fishing, right? You cast and you only want to catch crabs, but you cast a huge net and you catch everything in the sea, fish and octopus and everything else, and you pull that all up. And you might say, well, that's the only way we can catch crabs. But what was also interesting is that once you've done that, you don't throw the rest of the octopus and the other fish away. You keep all of that as well in case you want to have it later. And I think that's what's kind of troubling about this analogy.
The Washington Post. U.S. Mines internet firm's data documents show. The second document, which was published again, shook the planet. The code name of the program, PRISM, was revealed.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
اقرأ بسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآنك جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسانك ودعوتك ربي بقرآنك.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. Respected brothers and sisters, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem. Today, inshallah, we'll talk about Ayah 36 of Surah An-Nisa on page 84 of the Quran Kareem. So, this is a long ayah, but nice points are here. We'll mention shortly, then like a lot of tajweed rules are here, okay? That the most important ones, inshallah, we will mention. So, first and foremost, let's fawad Ali Nasir all together. And brothers and sisters, dear listeners, we will all together listen to the recitation. Then we'll get back to our lesson. Okay, 1, 2, 3, let's go.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. واعبدوا الله ولا تشركوا به شيئا وبالوالدين إحسانا وبذي القربى واليتامى والمساكين والجار ذي القربى والجار الجنب والصاحب بالجنب وابن السبيل وما ملكت أيمانكم إن الله لا يحب من كان مختالا فخورا.
Very nice recitation, mashallah. Very nice recitation. Let me read it once, okay, without tajweed. Then inshallah, after the short explanation, we'll mention the tajweed rules, then we'll recite it with tajweed rules, okay?
Yes.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. واعبدوا الله.